This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is Jason Hartman, your host. So we've got a great show for you today. We've got Ken McElroy. You probably know who that is. And one of our clients, Gary, mentioned him when I met with him in St. Louis. And I know you like Ken McElroy, so here he is for you. We had this show originally posted in the members section, but decided to bring it out and publish it with many requests as a fully published show. So I think you'll enjoy that today. And before we get to Ken, who is right here in my local Scottsdale area in Scottsdale, Arizona. I'm actually meeting him for breakfast next week, and I think you'll like his story about how he's created a lot of wealth and a lot of value for himself and a lot of other people in his investments in apartment buildings. So we'll get to that here in just a few minutes. Couple of things here, a couple of interesting news items that I thought would tickle your fancy before we get into it. One was a story from Yahoo Finance, and this has been going on, really the subject of this article, for years now. I've definitely been noticing it for at least a good 4, maybe 5 years, but it continues to happen, and it's another way that we see that our dollar is being debased and debased and debased. And again, when following our plan in terms of investing with long-term fixed-rate debt and investing in packaged commodities, in other words, the materials that go into construction of houses and apartments, you can put yourself in a very good position from all of this. So anyway, the article entitled "Looking for Inflation, It's Hiding in Smaller Package Sizes." Good things may come in small packages, but they certainly aren't good deals. Here's how your favorite grocery store items are shrinking before your very eyes. And this article is from Money Talks News. Len Penzo is the author. And it says, "Inflation? What inflation? The fact is, for those who are willing to look close enough, we're actually being confronted by a serious bout of deflation." Well, not really. Hang on a second. "At least when it comes to the size of containers sitting on supermarket shelves. With prices continuing to rise in the face of a depressed economic climate, manufacturers continue to find themselves caught in a classic dilemma. Either raise prices and risk losing customers, or stave off price increase by shrinking the size of their packaging ever so slightly." Anybody care to guess which option the company brass most often decides to take when faced with the need to make this kind of lose-lose decision? The evidence is all around you. Although I can't prove it, I suspect the majority of manufacturers ultimately decide that a little deception is worth it if it means they can hold back the dreaded price increases. A recent article on this topic in the New York Times provides plenty of circumstantial evidence. For example, chicken of the sea tuna now comes in 5-ounce cans as opposed to the traditional 6-ounce containers. Doritos, Fritos, and Tostitos reduce the quantity of chips in their bags by 20%. Tropicana recently dropped the size of their orange juice carton from 64 to 59 ounces. Now, you know, folks, that one's kind of interesting because 64 ounces is exactly half a gallon. A gallon is 128 ounces. So now they get all these odd package sizes. I mean, how confusing. And then the last one he cites here, just on this page, the article goes on and on, but I'll just finish with this. Nabisco's premium saltines and Honey Made Grahams have new packaging with 15% fewer crackers. So, in case anyone doesn't believe inflation is upon us, I highly encourage you to consider that article and so many other examples all around us. But again, that's good for us as investors following the plan we outline on the Creating Wealth Show, because we benefit dramatically from that.
Remember, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and Wednesday.
Okay, Diana Olick from CNBC had an interesting commentary lately in one of her stories, and I'll just share a little bit of it with you. She says, "I'm not sure if it's that usual New Year's Eve optimism evoked by the generic philosophy that the grass is always greener on the other side of the calendar year, or perhaps the emotional need to dig ourselves out of what has surely been one of the most lugubrious periods in the U.S. economy. But there is some hope in housing. A few positive readings in home sales and housing stats recently, topped off by today's 7.4% monthly jump in contracts to buy existing homes, are fueling what I dare say is a spark, albeit not a fire. They are also managing to trump what particularly opposing reading in home prices comes from the number crunchers at the S&P Case-Shiller this week." And you know, folks, as I've said so many times, the Case-Shiller Index, 75% of the measly 5% of the market that they index, only 20 out of about 400 markets, about 5%, 75% of those markets aren't worth considering. So again, it's just, that's so annoying the way our news media works in this country, because it is just so darn deceiving. But you know what? Let's be thankful they're deceiving the masses, because that leaves more opportunity for the rest of us who are in the know, in the inner circle. That was my commentary, by the way, obviously. She goes on to say, "Then there is a big story in the Wall Street Journal of hedge funds putting their money back into housing, suggesting that while the numbers aren't all there for a big win, these funds are usually ahead of big market shifts, so a housing surge must be on its way." Well, at least that's what they must think, right? "I've spoken to some of these hedge fund types as well, and they seem to be, now listen to this, folks, playing on the surging rental market for now. Playing on the surging rental market for now, getting the bargains, but not expecting any big, quote, flipping, unquote, returns soon. Bottom line, whether it's due to even lower prices, historically low mortgage rates, falling inventory, and a better tone in the labor market, or a combination of all, the housing market is showing signs of stabilizing." So that is pretty interesting, folks. There are some bright signs out there, but you know what? We don't necessarily need bright signs to make money in this market, because there are so many ways to exploit the multidimensional nature of income property, and that is the wonderful thing. Last thing before we get to Ken, well, couple last things. I've got one more little newsletter tidbit I want to share with you, but I appreciated all the comments I got from the last show I did with Ranting Andy, where we talked about Wall Street and the abject, complete scam that it is, but also the fact that I did the introduction for that show, the monologue portion, on the airplane. Yes, the first time. I guess the Creating Wealth show has now joined the Mile High Club, and there's a first for everything. So that was kind of odd to do it on an airplane, but you know, maybe we'll do that again sometime soon. But the last one, skyrocketing student loan debt will delay home ownership. And this is from John Burns Consulting. And, you know, I've talked about him. We had him on the show. His newsletters have some great information. They're really designed for the industry, for home builders, not really applicable to us necessarily or directly, but there are some here and there that are very, very applicable to us. And this is one of them. So in the newsletter, it goes on to say, "Skyrocketing student loan debt will delay home ownership. Student loan debt now totals $865 billion. Folks, that's almost $1 trillion with a T, remember. $865 billion, which is greater than all credit card debt outstanding, as well as all other types of household debt except for mortgages. If you listen to my Holistic Survival show at all, I got to tell you, and if you're thinking of sending your kids to college or an expensive college, I hate to say this because I'm a huge believer in education. I consider myself to be a very self-educated person, just interested in being a lifelong learner. I love to read. I love to go to seminars and listen to audio programs and just always learning. I consider that to be just a wonderfully enriching and stimulating lifelong endeavor learning. But college has become a bit of a ripoff. You've just got to admit. And the interesting thing about it, the conspiratorial side of this that I have discussed on the Holistic Survival Show, and if you want to know a little bit about it, there's an interesting little mini documentary. You can find it on YouTube. It's called The College Conspiracy. And it just talks about how college tuitions have just gone through the roof. And largely this is due to the government financing college educations. And the scary part about it is that student loan debt is not dischargeable in bankruptcy. So it is a way to have economic slavery or indentured servitude. So that's my take on the college thing. One of my employees comes to me every once in a while and says, you know, I think I should go back to college and all of this kind of stuff. And, you know, I feel like maybe I kind of missed out by not finishing college, et cetera, et cetera. And I say, look, if it were 1980 or 1985 or 1990, I would definitely say yes. In that era and before that, absolutely finish college. But, you know, nowadays, I don't know. I think the economics have changed so much and the job market has changed so much. And I'm not sure I'm as much of a believer in higher education as I used to be, especially at the prices. If it was reasonably priced, I mean, look, my mother she graduated from Berkeley, and, you know, she was toward the top of her class, and when she did it, she worked her way through college. I mean, you really could do it back then because college was reasonably priced in the old days, okay? But now it has just become so outrageously expensive. Maybe instead of spending $200,000 to send your kid to college, maybe you should take that $200,000 and buy them a couple of little income properties. As long as they're smart and interested in learning and being self-educated and making learning a lifelong process that no one has to twist their arm to do, that they're interested in and engaged in. And, you know, I'll be the first to admit, most people aren't like that, okay? I feel fortunate that I'm like that, and I know all of our listeners are probably like that, but most people aren't that way. But if you have a kid that is that way, just check out The College Conspiracy. That's an interesting video. I had those people on the show, the creators of that, talking about it, and there's a real case to consider some different options nowadays in today's economy. But anyway, back to the article that I was talking about student loan debt. So what's interesting here, the connection here for us as investors, is that this is going to massively delay homeownership. So let me go on here a little bit and I'll talk to you about it. First of all, there's a chart that looks at student loan default and how default rates are rising. And again, not dischargeable in bankruptcy. So why is that so significant? What do I mean when I keep saying that? That means that you can never get out of it. Student loan debt has to be repaid. It is a lifelong debt obligation. Whereas one of the things America is very tolerant about, and I'd say it's a good thing, it keeps our economy more vibrant than in many other countries, is it's very tolerant in this country about giving people a second chance. If you take a risk or you fall on hard times, you can declare bankruptcy and you can start over. And granted, I know some people declare bankruptcy like it's a business plan, and I personally know people who do that. I know famous people who do that, and many real estate gurus do that, and I don't think that is an ethical thing to do, declare bankruptcy every 7 years or 10 years or whatever the rule is for it. Certainly not. But if someone genuinely needs to get a fresh start in life, that's one of the great things that you can do in America, is you can start over. And a lot of these people that go through hard times or make mistakes, they can do BK and they can start fresh and they become big successes the second time around and contribute a whole lot to the economy, pay a lot of taxes, employ a lot of people. So there's definitely something to be said for the fact that in the U.S. you can get a second chance. Again, I've never done that. I've never needed to, thank God. But it's always there if someone needs to. But not with student loan debt. That is not dischargeable. So going on here, student loans are going to be yet another hurdle for the housing market to overcome. Now, the interesting thing about that is when you say housing market, and this is my commentary, what do they mean by housing market? They mean the purchase market. But for landlords, this is actually very good for the rental market, and I'll show you why in just a moment. That chart that I was talking about student loan default rates, in 2005, 4.6%, in 2009, 8.8%.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and every Wednesday.
So you can see how they have dramatically jumped over just a few short years. The article goes on to say, today's 36.8% homeownership rate for 25 to 29-year-olds is at its lowest level since 1999, and homeownership for 30 to 34-year-olds is at its lowest rate in 17 years. Now, this is my commentary. That demographic is like the holy grail of housing. Demographic, okay? That is an extremely important part of the housing market because that represents young people that are coming into their household formation years, their years where they're setting up a household, getting married, and going into debt and spending a lot of money and stimulating the economy, okay? So the article going on to say, the good news is that this pent-up demand will ultimately provide a much-needed boost to the housing sector. The bad news is that the boost is heavily skewed to the rental market. Did you hear that? The bad news is that this boost will be heavily skewed to the rental market, as it will take longer than ever for young people to qualify for a mortgage, especially if more and more graduates are hit with credit blemishes for unpaid student loan debt. So you know what, folks? That represents a whole bunch of new renters that we need to serve as investors, that we need to help, that we need to provide rental housing for. Article goes on to say, to help struggling graduates, the Obama administration recently announced a program to help those with student debt reduce their payments down to 10% of their income. However, with student loans at 10% of income, how will these people be able to qualify for a home? Now, going on here, there's one more chart, and this chart, if this chart doesn't tell it, I don't know what does. It's a chart entitled Total Renter Households, Total Renter Households. So in 2000, there were 33 million renter households, according to this. In 2005, 5 years later, there were, just a slight increase, 33.9 million renter households. But look at this. From 2005 to 2010, 3.8 million additional renter households, bringing the number up to 37.7 million. Now, if you think that's significant, watch what happens from 2010 to 2015, okay? Only 3 years from now, this number will have played out, and of course it's their projection, but you know, we're 2 years into it already at 2012, right? They think that the number of renter households will increase by, get this, 9.1 million. A 9.1 million increase. This is a dramatic increase to 46.8 million renter households. It says, all of these analysis contributes to our belief that the lion's share of the housing sector demand will end up in the rental market. Look at tremendous growth that we expect in rentals in comparison to the last decade. Wow. Well, that's what this show is about today with Ken McElroy. And I tell you, the future for us as investors, folks, it couldn't be brighter. Because as long as we're buying in the right markets, where we're buying below the cost of replacement or construction, and if we're able to finance, we're even more fortunate. Because think about it, if you take out a mortgage today, you're not going to make the last payment on that mortgage until 2042. 3 decades from now, 30 years from now, can you imagine how much inflation there will be between now and then? Can you imagine how the world is going to change between now and then? Can you imagine the increases in population? Can you imagine the reduction in home ownership rates as more people damage their credit, as more people have student loan debt to overcome, as more people fall on hard times, as more people get foreclosed on, as more people cycle back from the homeownership market into the rental market? What if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are put out of business like they should be? What is that going to do to the renter population? Remember, approximately every 1% drop in the homeownership rate equals 1 million new renters. And at our Meet the Masters event, I think it was three Meet the Masters events ago, we did a presentation 6 years, 6 million new homeowners, saying that that was a conservative number. We think that the rate could be as high as 25 million new renters. So 6 years, 6 million new renters. Hey, that would be a phenomenal opportunity for us investors. But what if we get 25 million new renters? Can you imagine the upward pressure that will put on rental prices and the upward pressure it'll put on commodities prices, on construction materials? I mean, my gosh, can you imagine the price of lumber, of wallboard, of glass, of steel, of concrete, of all the ingredients for a house, of copper wire, petroleum products, I mean, energy to build houses? It is unbelievable what that will do. And now we have the opportunity to buy at half the cost of these materials. We can get them for half price today. Okay, in many, many markets, we can get the land thrown in for free. We can finance them for 30 years, for three decades, at the lowest mortgage rates in about, give or take, with a few exceptions here and there, maybe five decades. Unbelievable opportunity. You want to hear more about that opportunity? Be sure you join us for our Meet the Masters event. You know, we've been a little slow in planning this one, so we will probably do that, and we just had another person sign up today. We will probably do that in mid-March, and we will announce the exact date real soon, and then we will probably do it again, our second one, a little bit earlier this year, and we'll probably do that one in Southern California, maybe in August, September. So you can just kind of have your calendar planned for that. Many, many people come to every Meet the Masters event, and we always appreciate seeing you again. If you haven't been to this event, be sure to register. Go to jasonhartman.com. Tickets are heavily discounted for early birds, so take advantage of that. It's kind of like buying your income properties for half the cost of construction, our heavily discounted Meet the Masters ticket prices. So jasonhartman.com, register for that. And also take a look at some of the phenomenal properties we have in the properties section. We've been doing a booming business in so many markets now. Atlanta is hot. St. Louis is hot. Dallas is hot. Phoenix too. I mean, they're all good, but just business being quite strong now and something you definitely want to take advantage of. It's a great feeling because nobody has to talk anybody into investing in income property nowadays. The people who are in the know, they know it's a good deal. As long as you're not doing it in expensive cities in California or the Northeast or Chicagoland or areas like that just don't make any sense. They really never did. So that's not what we're talking about. Okay, we will be back with Robert Kiyosaki, rich dad author Ken McElroy here to talk about his investment career, which is pretty darn amazing. And we'll be back with that in just a moment.
Are you interested in a property outside of our network? Do you need a second opinion? No problem. Let Jason's experts evaluate the deal. For more information, go to jasonhartman.com now.
My pleasure to welcome Ken McElroy to the show. You've probably heard his name. He's a very well-known investor and author. He's written four books now, three of them in the Rich Dad series with Robert Kiyosaki, and he is responsible for having purchased over $300 million in real estate in just the past 2 years, but he's got over 20 years of senior level experience in multifamily property management, development, construction, disposition, analysis, acquisitions, and business development. So quite a resume. And you may have read Ken's books. He's a great speaker. He's inspired audiences from around the world. It's been on PBS and just a whole bunch of things. Very widely known name. Probably doesn't need much more of an introduction. But from Scottsdale, Arizona, Ken McElroy, how are you today?
Jason, how are you? Thank you for the nice introduction.
Well, my pleasure. I'm a big fan, been following your work for many years. And I was just giving myself a little refresher in preparation for our interview today. And in reading the ABCs of real estate investing and the advanced guide to real estate investing, Ken, one of the things you talked about in there that I think is so appropriate is how you were reading Money Magazine a few years back and how they compare stocks to income property and just how misleading really the traditional media is out there. I'm not sure if you remember what you wrote, actually, because it was quite a few years back, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I think, Jason, like you and many people that I know and talk to, I think it's all very confusing, you know, and I'm no different. I'll walk up to a bookstore at the airport or wherever, and I'll grab a magazine that talks about something way different than I'm in, just because I want to learn a little bit about it. And that's exactly what happened in this particular case. I picked up the issue of Money Magazine at the time, and it basically was comparing stocks and real estate. And of course, I didn't know what it was going to say, and I just read it on the plane. And I just, knowing both, I just really felt like it was really slanted. And I got a little bit angry because I think a lot of people read some of these things. And you know, it just adds to the who do you trust category. And it just pissed me off. And so I started to break it down. And, you know, I happened to be writing a book at the time. And I put it in the book. And then what I did is I actually went to Money Magazine and I told them I was interested in advertising. And I had them send me the advertising rate card. And then I went back in and I looked and I counted up all the financial services ads in that particular magazine. And I think it totaled somewhere over $3 million for that issue. And I'm not a conspiracy guy, but it was just frustrating that it was all slanted towards stocks, because I felt like that, you know, that's who their client was.
Right, right. Well, I think it'd be hard to say that $3 million wouldn't influence any of us. It's just really sad. I mean, fortunately, so many people in America and around the world are finally waking up to the fact that Wall Street isn't going to do it for you. Wall Street is nothing more than a distribution system for mediocre to lousy assets, in my opinion. There's really only two ways to do it, Ken. You know, if people want to be financially free, they've got to invest in income property, and or they've got to have their own business. And even if they don't have their own business as a primary source of income, I say they should at least have their own side business so they can get some additional tax deductions, if nothing else. But income property is the most tax-favored asset in America, bar none, with depreciation and so forth. It's just phenomenal. Then you talk about the 10 advantages, and maybe you can share just a couple of those great 10 advantages of income property and especially multifamily apartments with our listeners today.
Well, as you can imagine, the world was in a little bit different spot. My first book I wrote was in 2004. And just to give you a little background, I have been buying real estate and managing real estate really since I was in college or university. And I happen to be out raising capital, just like so many of us do. Well, they find something and they get educated. And I ran into Robert Kiyosaki, and I honestly did not know about Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I did not know, you know, his philosophy or anything like that. But I did know that my tenants could pay off my mortgage, you know what I mean, on the stuff that
right.
I had. So we were aligned in that way when we were introduced by a mutual friend. And I had not planned on even writing a book. And as my English teacher would probably also say, it was never something that I thought I would do. But when I did, I realized I had all this stuff in me from the things I had learned and the mistakes I had made. And what I realized is, you know, I had this crazy, really neat opportunity to be able to manage for people for 10 years. So I had an opportunity to meet all these high net worth people that were buying all these properties all over, particularly up in the Northwest and in Nevada and Arizona and California. And I got to understand how to run them. I got to understand, you know, that you have to increase the income and you have to reduce the expenses and, you know, it has to cover its mortgage to be able to develop cash flow. And I built these phenomenal relationships during that period of time. And that was really the baseline for me to be able to go out and do it myself. So then what I did was I first bought a condo, a two-bedroom, two-bath condo that cash flowed. It didn't cash flow very much, but it cash flowed. And then I just started getting bigger properties. I got a duplex, and then a fourplex, and an eightplex. And then I, you know, eventually now we buy these large projects. And so the advantages that I have learned really, Jason, from the beginning is have changed. I realize that the, you know, especially now with the dollar kind of dropping and inflation pending, I never understood the power of leverage, you know, until let's say 5, 6, 7 years ago, when initially I thought it was just all about real estate and cash flow. And I realize now it's how powerful of a vehicle this is to hedge inflation and And, you know, what's better than buying something and having a tenant paying off for you? You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Nothing's better. But also the fact that you pay, or I should say your tenant repays your debt in depreciated dollars. So that's a phenomenal opportunity there. And that, I think, really, Ken, is the hidden wealth creator that made so many people so wealthy over the last couple of decades. Most people think the real estate went up in value, and it did, but in real dollars, it's kind of debatable how much it did. But the debt was just destroyed by inflation, and that's just the phenomenal hidden thing that most people just don't get.
It's true, and you know, when I first started buying properties, you know, and management is so important, and you know, and making sure the income goes up and the expenses are in line, and all that is so incredibly important. And I started raising equity, you know, and making sure that my investors' capital was preserved, and that people, you know, they had their confidence in us, you know, we're getting returns and cash flow back out, because ultimately, that's why you do this, and that's why you raise equity, you know, for those purposes. And I think why Robert and I were aligned is because, you know, he's always been a cash flow guy, always, and as opposed to a capital gains guy. And I've never really felt comfortable with trying to say, I'm going to buy something at, you know, one price and hopefully it goes up and I can sell it at a higher price and that's how I'm going to make it. To me, that's just a lot of it is just really timing and luck. And so I always felt like, if I can manage something really well and keep it full and it cash flowed based on that, then that was a much more controllable way to make my investors money. And so that's kind of the philosophy, you know, that we've adopted at our company, you know, for the last 15 years.
Yeah, no question about it. Cash flow is a pretty reliable thing. It's not perfectly reliable. Nothing is, but it's pretty reliable. But capital gains, that's luck. I mean, you just can't rely on capital gains. And I see so many people out there, Ken, who are constantly chasing the end of the rainbow, waiting for their ship to come in. The kind of the dreamers, they think it's going to be one big payoff, but it's not really one big payoff, is it? It's the ongoing result of just good, sound investments that produce income, right?
Yeah, and not to mention the fact that now I'm I've been in the business long enough that I actually challenged that whole retirement philosophy. Period. You know, I know person after person after person that, you know, goes and they get that brass ring at the end of it, whatever they feel, you know, their retirement age is, but if they don't have any kind of purpose or any kind of, you know, something that drives them day to day to day, they kind of wither on the vine anyway. And so for me, this is a lifelong lesson. You know, I'm investing people's money. I'm trying to learn markets. You know, I'm studying demographics and movements of the interest rates and the euro and the dollar and all that stuff's interrelated, and inflation and all that stuff is very fascinating. And, you know, and for whatever reason, I never took to it in school. I didn't get it then, but now I do. And now that I'm handling other people's money than my own money and managing, you know, these assets, it's important, I think, that you stay on top of these things and watch them as they continue to change.
Sure. Yeah, definitely is. The demographics right now are pretty exciting out there. We've got Generation Y. That's the largest demographic cohort in American history, just slightly larger than the baby boomers by about 4 million. And a lot of them are living at home a lot longer than before. Part of that's probably due to the economy. But demographics are looking pretty good for rental housing now, aren't they?
Yeah. You know, it's funny that you're talking about that now. Of course, rental housing's all I've been involved in really since I was in college. And I've watched the different cycles. And each time credit becomes really cheap and rentals or residential housing or residential construction gets really, really active, then it pulls people out of rentals. And, you know, you always see the signs. If you lived here, you'd be home by now, you know, and you know, why rent when you can buy and all that stuff? Well, that's normal, and that's going to happen again. And, you know, each time it swings the other way, it favors rentals. And right now, Jason, you know, we're starting to see, you know, under the Bush administration, the home ownership went all the way up to almost 69%, which is the highest it's ever been. And it's coming back down. right now I think it's around 66, and they're saying it could get as low as 64 to 63. The year-over-year average has been 66, and whatever happens, it's gonna retract back. Well, every 1 point is a million renters that kind of get forced back into the rental housing. And so that's an interesting statistic that I think we all have to keep in mind. And it's going to be different in each individual submarket. And every, demographics are, as you mentioned, are going to drive this. One of the things that happens in the Gen Y sector is these kids, because they don't have, the last thing you want to do is live at home. You know what I mean? And, but they don't have any choice at the moment. They don't have any income. There's no real jobs. Even the kids coming out of college don't have jobs. So they default back. Thank God they have that option to default back. But now the highest number of kids living at home ever recorded, 22 million, are sitting there. When and if we get jobs, those kids will come back into the workforce and they'll move into rental housing. So we have that kind of pent-up demand. Then you have, on the other side, you have all these folks that bought homes with zero down or 10% down, and they have all these mortgage resets. Well, as those mortgages get reset, or as they lose their houses and they decide that they're just so far underwater, they're coming back into rental housing, a lot of them, because why would you have a mortgage so significantly higher than a comparable house that you can rent for much lower? So now when I talk about rental housing, I'm not talking about apartments. I'm talking about houses. I'm talking about condos. I'm talking about townhomes. I'm talking about everything, really. So we really are having this huge resurgence back into the rental market. And there really is no end in sight for probably 3 or 4 years, just to eat up some of the supply. And it's very, very exciting times if you own property and you're in on the landlord side of the equation.
Yeah, no question about it. All of those people will find a way to somehow, if they're in a house that's underwater, that the payment just doesn't make sense anymore, they're going to find a way to get out of it. They're going to short sale. They're going to try loan modification. That's pretty difficult to do most of the time. But they're going to get out of that property. And many of them have damaged their credit. And some of them have done it with strategic defaults, where they've been living in their house for a year for free. They saved up all that money. And maybe that's the reason consumer spending was so good this holiday season. I don't know. I always kind of wonder that. But they're going to go out and they're going to recycle into the rental market. And they're just going to be another customer for us landlords, aren't they?
They are. And I'll tell you what, Jason, we have 8,000 units now. So I have well over 10,000 tenants between Arizona and Texas. So I'm really on the ground. I get to see the occupancy, the issues that happen day to day, the rentals, the move outs day to day at all our projects. And I'm telling you, and I, of course, been in the business a long time and been very involved in multiple organizations that all have to do with multifamily as an investment or rental housing of some sort. And my peers are all experiencing higher occupancy, higher income, and better credit from the renter. And I think that the only thing that's going to offset that is additional supply. And that's not coming anytime soon because of financing.
Right. And the building is almost completely kaput. I mean, there's hardly any building going on at all. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a phenomenal time to be moving into the real estate investment landlording side of the business, the dairy farmer side, as Robert Kiyosaki puts it, not the cattle rancher where you're planning to flip, but where you buy and hold good properties and milk them like a dairy farmer milks a cow. What are some of the reasons that you like apartments so much versus office buildings or retail properties? I just never was very interested in those properties. I think they're incredibly complex, incredibly capital intensive and management intensive. Housing, 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 if you ask me. I think you agree. What are your thoughts?
That's a great question. I have very, very good friends in all those sectors. And one of the things that I like about apartments is, well, first of all, why I like the larger ones is what I learned as managing the smaller properties, even though that's where I got all my experience and I would definitely recommend it to anybody, is that they're tougher to manage it without a staff. So, like everyone, at some point I got the call to move out and I needed to paint the unit or the, you know, the toilet that was overflowing or the tenant next door, all that stuff. So I fielded all those calls. But once I got to, I realized that once you get to some of these larger projects, then it actually supports a staff. And it's actually better from a customer service standpoint, number one, but it's also better from my standpoint where I don't have to actually have those phone calls come in because they kind of get handled right then. Like if somebody has an issue, on a maintenance side, you know, they go down to the office and there's somebody there. They're handling it right then. And so those don't always filter up to the office. And so that's why we ended up going into the larger projects. With respect to the comparison between residential or office or industrial, et cetera, I personally like the fact that housing, I just felt like it was such a basic staple, and retail and office was not as necessary as apartments. So, you know, to me, it just seemed like it satisfied more of the masses. Like from a retail standpoint, you were always subject to the actual tenant in that particular space, whether it's a pet store, a flower store, a tuck shop, or whatever. You know, you were always kind of reliant on the independent skills or the location of that particular person, how they could run their place. And whereas apartments were, if it was priced right, it was a great location, it was clean, and it was managed well, and there was great customer service, then, you know, I could kind of manipulate and control my own income, you know, by occupancy and, you know, putting really good staff in there. And so for me, it was, again, just really a lot closer to being able to control the financial outcome of the asset.
And with apartments, one of the things I'm trying to do with my own portfolio, and I hope the listeners are too, is you start with the single family homes, you move up, and you get more and more units, you do bigger projects. And isn't it about 70 units and over, Ken, where you can get that good on-site management? Usually the property will support it with about 70 units.
Yeah, that's about right. I think, you know, you can, with a 70 unit property, you can actually have two people, and you know, depending on the rents and the expenses and where it is and all that. But generally, a 70-unit property will support two people. And I think that, you know, again, if you have a vacancy and you have somebody there, you're not, you know, you're not placing an ad and you're not driving over there and meeting somebody. And you actually have somebody physically there that can, you know, so sometimes the vacancy gap and all and the maintenance issues and the customer service issues, all that gets tightened up and you know, which all boils into resident retention. And you know, we try to keep our residents and our tenants for the long term. And we have entire programs based around resident retention to try to keep people there and keep them happy. And because generally people move from rental to rental, especially today. And if they're moving out, I want to know why and what, you know, what did we do right or what did we do wrong? And you know, that's part of the whole business piece.
Sure it is. Yeah. And to your point where you're talking about comparing these different sectors, you know, industrial property, retail property, office space, to apartment buildings or to houses, housing is a requirement. It's a basic human need, food, clothing, and shelter. Ken, I look at like the macro trend of it too. You mentioned some of the micro trends, and I'm sure you thought of these, but they can outsource the manufacturing to China. They can outsource the call centers to India, lessening the need for office space, or the Philippines. The factories go to China, lessening the need for industrial property. Outsource shopping to some extent to the internet. And what do you have? You got Fortune 1000 companies telling their employees to work out of the house, because look at, from a company's perspective, all the problems that just disappear when employees work virtually. They're not in an office, so they're not subject to office politics so much, or wasting time around the water cooler, or sexual harassment lawsuits, or OSHA requirements, or all these crazy things that you've got to do as an employer when you put people together in an office space. And you can really see, you know, why companies are doing that. And all of this lessens the need for every other sector. Yet at the same time, it increases the need for housing because our population is still increasing, even now with this economy in the United States, isn't it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Those are all really, really good points. I you know, I am very concerned about all those things you just said. And I know, you know, the wave, everybody's buying, especially this season, they're buying off of Amazon, they're getting things delivered. You know, they're not going out and battling and, you know, like they were. And all that translates into less retail and particularly less office. And I don't know where all that's going to go, but what I do know is from a demographic standpoint, you know, we have this big demand right now with renters from the things we mentioned before, and we don't have the supply offset. And we, just as a country, we need 250,000 units delivered annually just to keep up with demand and population growth. And we've been delivering, you know, 50, 75, 100,000 units over the last 3 years. We're significantly below supply. And that's not even counting the people that are actually falling out, you know, back into the rental market. So it is really, I do want to be cautious about one thing, though, Jason, and that is not every market is treated the same.
No question. That's the next question I wanted to cover. You know, you've got a chapter, the next top 10 markets to watch. And I couldn't agree more that all real estate is local, isn't it, Ken?
Yeah, it is. You know, you really, really got to be careful. And, you know, as I travel around with Robert, and we're now raising money in Canada and in, you know, South America and Mexico. And you know, we're investing people's money from all over the world. And it's funny because these people have all been duped in one case or another by buying single families for, you know, 30, 40 grand in certain areas, or a $500, you know, home in Detroit.
Those are, you know, crappy. Those just don't
they
work.
Are.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, from the outside looking in, I totally get it.
It
I
seems
understand.
Like a great deal. It seems it's like a free house. Why wouldn't you take
it?
But a responsibility comes with that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's true. So I, you know, for what we do is the same thing that you do is, you know, we take a real macro view of where are the jobs, where's the population, what areas are overbuilt, what areas are undersupplied, what's happening with employers, where are they moving? And that's all part of real estate. And if you can be ahead of that curve and try to buy in areas, for example, we bought this year, I bought 1,500 apartments in San Antonio alone. And the reason I bought there is because their largest employer for San Antonio is healthcare. And I believe, based on, you know, what we talked about a little bit ago with this demographic, is these baby boomers, and we haven't really talked about a lot about these folks, they're going to be looking for, I think, places where they can afford to live and have health care and climates that are nice. And San Antonio jumps right out of the, you know, in all the Texas markets for that particular reason. So we bought in the area around the Texas Medical Center and USAA Insurance and, you know, kind of in the northeast and north central northeast section of San Antonio for that very, very reason. We don't want to buy properties that aren't going to have tenants.
Let me take a brief pause. We'll be back in just a minute.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn how to finance your next big real estate deal, there's a show for that. If you want to learn more about food storage and the best way to keep those onions from smelling up everything else, there's a show for that. If you honestly want to know more about business ethics, there's a show for that. And if you just want to get away from it all and need to know something about world travel, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com. Or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
Well, you generally like Arizona and Texas quite a bit, don't you? You know, I completely know what you mean when you look at Michigan. I mean, Michigan is a disaster and a half. The population is decreasing. Detroit, the population's been cut in half in the last couple of decades, while everything else practically is growing. I mean, it's completely opposite the trend. And big government and unions have just pushed businesses out. They've just gotten rid of them. But, I mean, am I right in saying really Arizona, Texas are your two main interests?
Well, we're actually tracking Seattle, Portland, Salt Lake City, all the major markets in Texas. You know, we like obviously Southern California and in some areas of Northern California.
Now, let me ask you about that if I can. You said obviously Southern California, as if I should take that for granted.
Sure.
That was interesting. See, I think California, almost the whole state, has a pretty difficult RV ratio, rent-to-value ratio, doesn't it? I mean, it's great. The Irvine Company is obviously doing great there, but their basis is so low. The Irvine Company, they got that land for nothing forever ago, but everybody else, the prices you have to pay in Southern California compared to the rents you get. I mean, I know the market is tight. I know that. I know that apartments are, the occupancy is high, but they're expensive to buy. What are your thoughts?
There's no question. I mean, everything that you said is correct. And my good friend is the president of Irvine Company. And so I understand where they came from and how all that worked. And you know, and that was a, you know, that was years and years and years in the making. But the what I mean by Southern California and even parts of Northern California is, you know, again, I'm looking at population and employment growth just purely because of the area. And one of the things that I like about some of those particular markets is that in order to start something new, the ability to add supply in those markets is so, so difficult.
Right. And that's pretty much because of government and environmentalists. And it is. It's very difficult to add supply. It's interesting you bring that point up. I was talking with, and this was about a year ago, but I just never forget. It's one of those conversations I just won't forget. It was a manufacturer of, we were looking at self-storage facilities. And so they manufacture these self-storage facilities, which are basically like you can assemble a self-storage facility in a week. If you have a piece of land and it's all approved, you can come out there and just put these buildings up. They're all like modular and they're really easy to do. And he was saying that they did a project, I think it was they did a project in Missouri, and they did it in 4 days. They built the whole thing. And they did one in Northern California, in like the Napa area, in the wine country area. It took 4 years because they had to have environmental impact reports, studies. There was some little bug they had to worry about. And it's just, this is why I can't stand California. But I get where you're coming from on the constrained supply.
Yeah, but I tell you, you bring up a great point. I have a very good friend that has 40,000 mini storage units in Nevada. He's the largest mini storage owner, self-storage owner, and I was just with him last week, actually, up in Las Vegas. We went to the ASU Boise State game up there, and we were talking, and essentially he said, you know, it's funny, there's a lot of people jumping into my business right now, but at the end of the day, it's still all about demographics. And we were talking about a piece that over here in Arizona, which is directly across from the Arizona Stadium, Phoenix Stadium here where the Cardinals play. And he said, well, what do you think about that area? And we were talking it through. And, you know, his demographics and what he looks at are so far different than mine. And he said, you know, I'd rather be in the middle of a neighborhood with, you know, these kinds of demographics and this household income. And so the point is he's been in the business for 20 years. He has his particular model on things that are successful or not that successful. And I think ultimately that's what we're talking about here is it's not just go out and try something somewhere. There's so much more to it, you know, because if you can't fill it, it's not going to work.
And I think that's a very key thing that you just mentioned, Ken. Everybody has their model. They have sort of the things they like. I mean, I've got a buddy, Chris, and he's been investing for years. He's done very well. But, you know, his model is just, I don't know. I just don't really agree with it that much. And he does well with his stuff. I do well with my stuff. And it's just different. You can slice and dice different segments of the market, different specialties. There isn't only one right way to do it. So, yeah, no question about that.
People see things differently. And the custom home builder looks at something one way, the single family production guy another way, the condo guy another way. You know, the apartment guy, the retail guy, you know, then you got high-end custom, low-end custom. I mean, everything's just a little bit different, you know, and I think the key to this business is understanding your particular niche. You know, what we do is just apartments, and everything that drives it is employment, population growth, and trends.
Yeah. Well, any other things that you want to mention in terms of like the next top 10 markets or employment trends or anything like that? I mean, that's obviously a great topic and everybody wants to know the future.
Yeah. Well, I think actually what I'm most concerned about is inflation. So if you study, one of the guys that I saw that you had on your show was Richard Duncan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, Richard and I are friends. I've read his books. I think he's phenomenal. You know, as you know, he was with the IMF and he lives in Thailand. So he has a very objective view of what's happening here. And he's, you know, he taught me a lot about trade imbalance and all the things. And again, that's part of the reason why I like to travel around with Robert, because I meet some of these folks that just add a little bit to, you know, what I thought I knew, and just kind of fine tunes it all. And so one of the things I'm most concerned about is the fact that we're so underwater as a country, and we have to, print all this money to, you know, pay our bills essentially. And I do believe that that's going to translate into inflation. And why that's important is because if you're saving money in the bank, which is what everybody's been doing, because they've been putting a lot of money in the bank, then that money is going to buy less later. That's what inflation does to it. So I'm not advocating real estate. I'm not advocating gold or silver or anything else. But what I'm saying is you need to understand that if inflation comes, the money that you have in your bank account is going to be worth less. So the thing to do is to get educated and to figure out what can I put that money into that potentially is inflation hedged. In other words, what goes up with inflation? If you just Google that, you'll be fine. You know what I mean? And just start to look for things, you know, what should I put my money in that rises with inflation? And, you know, and so to me, Jason, I think that's our biggest issue. And, you know, so what I've been doing in my asset class is I've been buying as many apartments as I can, and I've been putting fixed rate debt on. So I don't have any floating loans. And I don't have any recourse loans, which means that all my loans are non-recourse, which means I don't personally guarantee anything. So the rates that we've been locking at have been like 4.3, 4.4, 4.5, 10-year money. And, you know, at some point, if rates go up, which they're projected to do at some point, and the rates are 6 or 7, let's say, which they've been in the past, all of a sudden, my assets become very important to, you know, future investors, because I'm going to have my properties are assumable. So people can step into my shoes. They can buy my property with a 4.5% loan on it. And all of a sudden, that's a few million dollars worth of value to the next guy.
Oh, no question about it. People should look at that like a bond almost, Ken. Think about it. When you have a bond and it's paying a certain rate of return, I mean, just always put oneself on the other side of the equation. If you buy a bond and it pays X percent, and then the future bonds come out and they pay a lower percentage, your bond has become more valuable. It's the same with your income property. If the rates are higher so that a future landlord or investor needs to come along and pay a higher rate, then that mortgage, that debt you have, becomes an asset and not a liability. And also, that's usually in sync with an inflationary environment where you pay the debt back, or really your tenants, because you outsource your debt with income property, your tenants pay your debt back for you in ever cheaper dollars. So you win really two ways already, but then there's a third way, because what you really own when you own single family homes or apartment buildings or fourplexes is you own a bunch of commodities, a bunch of construction materials, as long as they're in low land value areas, because those construction materials have always been a great hedge against inflation. Concrete, lumber, copper wire, petroleum products that, you know, are involved in building the house or the apartment building, all those materials, those tend to hedge very well against inflation, don't they?
You're exactly right on. You know, and you asked me about the markets. What we're studying is which markets are progressive and why. And so what do I think is going to grow? I think university and education always grows in recessions, always. Because, you know, if kids are still in school and there's no jobs, they keep going to school.
Might as well stay in school, get a master's degree.
Yeah, I know. I know it's crazy, but it's true. You know, and healthcare, and you know, there's some, and you know, anything related to pharmaceuticals and medical. So if you just follow, you know, the very, you step back from everything and you say, okay, what's happening? We have a, you know, we have a new group coming in, the Gen Ys, and we have a, you know, the baby boomers kind of moving out, and you just know that, you know, those two groups have certain trends happening to them, and you just follow it, and you just try to be in front of it. That's all I'm trying to do. Energy being another one, I think, you know, which is why I like Dallas, Texas, you know, the oil and gas and natural gas and wind, and you know, they're very progressive. And, you know, we're in Houston, we're in Austin, we're in San Antonio, we're in Fort Worth. So I'm in all those markets. And each one's different, completely different.
Yeah. Yeah, they sure are. They sure are. Well, Ken, this has been fascinating. Anything else? Yeah, I'm just looking at one of your books here, and they're all great. But anything else you want to tell us just to kind of start wrapping up here about the purchase process or equity and financing? I mean, obviously, leverage is the holy grail of income property, assembling a great management team, and anything like that, any of those
things. Sure, yeah. Well, I tell you what, I think that we have about a year and a half to 2 year window to be able to take advantage of these low interest rates. So I think you're going to have a 1 year time frame to, you know, while before the presidential election, to take advantage of borrowing. So whatever you're doing, whether it's business or real estate or whatever it is, I think you need to take a look at using leverage, because, you know, these rates are so low, and you can borrow at such cheap dollars right now. And, you know, my latest book, The Sleeping Giant, which is about entrepreneurship and creating businesses, I know you and I spoke about this a little bit, Jason. I really believe that, you know, the normal job, you know, if you have that 9-to-5 job, it's going to be very, very difficult for people to keep up with inflation, and it's going to be very, very difficult to keep up with their savings eroded from, you know, from the dollar, and they're going to have some kind of supplemental stream of income, like you said, part-time, full-time, real estate business or something. They're going to have to do that just to stay ahead.
They definitely are. They definitely are. And that's good advice, to get oneself on the right side of the equation as inflation hits, and put inflation on your side, because it's coming. And Ken, you mentioned inflation being such a big concern. Everybody I have on the show, I ask them this question, and nobody knows the answer. Of course, it's a prediction. But how much inflation and when? Any thoughts? I mean, are we looking at 20% a year, 100% a year, or is it just 15%, which is totally mild historically? What do you think there?
Well, again, it's all, you know, I'm going to have a very similar answer, I guess, from some of your other guests. But I think that the reported inflation that we've been getting and what really is happening is different. So in other words, you know, we've been reporting, let's just say 4. I think it's actually been, you know, upwards of 8. You know, there's all kinds of websites that, you know, kind of support that based on the basket of goods that, you know, that they use. But essentially, I had an opportunity to talk to some people, you know, that you know, invest at a very, very high level and you know, are more on the economist side of things. And here's why they say we don't have inflation yet. They said the first stage of a recession, people start to save. So all the money that's in circulation in the economy, all the money that's been printed and all that stuff is actually in people's bank accounts. And if you'll notice, that's why banks are now saying they're charging you to open an account, right? It's the exact opposite of what it used to be.
Right,
remember,
you used to get a toaster.
Yeah, right, right. Now they're charging you. So there's a lot of money in the system. And so we won't actually see inflation hit until people start to feel comfortable and start to feel like there's some stability on the employment, you know, on the employment side of things, and the economy's kind of settled out a little bit. And so once they start to feel that, Jason, then they're going to start spending again. And when that money starts to enter the system, that's when we'll start to see inflation. So in other words, the money is out there, it's parked, as you can see if you look at savings rates. But when it starts to come back into the economy, we'll start to see inflation hit. And at that point, I think it's going to be fairly significant. It'll be it'll be interesting to see what they report, but my guess is going to be between 6 and 8%.
Yeah, and so the consumer price index obviously totally understates it. Anybody that looks at shadowstats.com or just looks at their bills, you know, they go to the grocery store, pay utility bills, they realize inflation is much higher than that. So we all know that that's a bogus measure, no question about it. But when that inflation genie gets out of the bottle, Ken, it's hard to put it back in and contain it. Everybody's got to follow Ken's advice and position yourself for it because it is coming, and to some extent, it's already here. Ken McElroy, give out your website again, if you would.
Sure. It's kenmcelroy.com. So it's KenMcElroy.com.
All right. Well, Ken, thank you so much for joining us today. Great insights. Keep up the good work out there and keep acquiring more units.
Thanks, Jason. Great chatting with you. Appreciate being on your show.
Now's your opportunity to get the Financial Freedom Report. The Financial Freedom Report provides financial self-defense in uncertain times, and it's your source for innovative, forward-thinking investment property strategies and advice. Get your newsletter subscription today. You get a digital download and even more. Go to jasonhartman.com to get yours today. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individual